jails across the nation. Some of the, I'm informed of them in full, in detail, I've been informed. Some of them, I know a little bit about them. There are really thousands of our youngsters and groups who have great motivations, who are zealous, and they are involved in their work. They do scientific research, industrial research, in industry and agriculture. They're active in health and medicine. They do lots of scientific work and also divinity schools. We have some scholars who are talented. They're doing their own job and different things. They have new things to say. We have some cultural activities all over the country that are being conducted. You know, they in the writing and book writing and arts and cinema and different fields of art and religion, propagation, and also in inspiring hope across the Wax people. You know, the different, we had different Islamic festivals and occasions, and you saw all these ceremonies were held. And this is the job of our youth. And these are all things that inspire hope. It shows that our youth are busy. They're doing their jobs. So unfortunately, when it comes to, we do not actually show and reflect all what we are doing properly. There are lots of things that we are doing, but not all of them are being reflected properly. This is a source of hope, and it shows that the people, especially our youth, are moving, they are working, they are not sitting idle by, they are thinking, and they are hopeful. And then you see there are some people who are really negligent, in my opinion, and they simply look at the dark side of everything. So they simply deny the existence of hope among our youth, or they sometimes even try to make them lose their hope. And why is that? Who does that benefit? Well, they write in order to come up with some reason that you cannot pin your hope in the future. This is something that I see. They exist. So they write articles, they have their own reasonings that you should never pin your hope in the future. Why not? We have so many hope-inspiring elements today. It's like as if they are lurking in a corner, try to kind of kill this hope in the hearts of our youth. For long years, the adversaries have been doing this. They have not been able to succeed. For long years, they have been using their own propaganda, and they have been using all kind of tricks and gimmicks and ploys. In different ways, by media, they try to aggrandize our points of weakness. Yes, we do have weaknesses in the country, but they try to aggrandize it 10 times as big. We have some progresses. They try to even ignore the progresses we have made or try to undermine them. Like military, for example, commanders, let's say they have created some missile or rocket or something. They launch it, they test fire it. And then when you see the other side, they say, no, this is a lie. This is what you see. The video was there. It's already launched or fired. They just deny that. This is what the enemy is doing. But inside the country, why should we do such a thing? I mean, there are some individuals who I believe are negligent. We should not allow ourselves to close our eyes on all these accomplishments. We should not make this mistake. So my advice for our youth is that they should move ahead of the enemy's schemes and plans. They need to move forward. The enemy wants to make you lose your hope. They want to bring you despair. More than what the enemy tries to kill your hope, you need to try to inspire hope, to try to move and try to bring hope to others, both nationally and internationally. You hear some voices that the adversaries do not want them to be heard. So define the enemy attempts. You need to use different tools and means that you have at your disposal and to make those voices heard. Now, the other point regarding national interest is the issue of unity among the people. People's hearts and minds, their determination. Unfortunately, we are facing some problems in this connection. Synergy and sympathy, this is really important. And we have been negligent, and our national unity, we have harmed it in a way, and unfortunately all of us are sharing this negligence. We are duty-bound when it comes to unity among the people and unity among the officials. We need to safeguard that. We need to boost it day after day. This is the principle followed by the Islamic Republic since the very day one after the Islamic Revolution victory. The late Imam Khomeini, one of the things that he emphasized was the issue of unity. Well, you see some on political issues or factional issues, we had some differences. And then the late Imam Khomeini would warn them that you should raise your voice and cry directed at the U.S. Slogans of death to America. So if there are individuals, differences, you know, there are differences in taste, you know, political issues, this is natural. But hate-mongering is something else. So you have your opinion, somebody else's own opinion. Well, they are not the same, and there is nothing wrong with that. But this should not cause hatred to spread. You should not do something so that you would hate one another, so that you act like enemies against each other, to set somebody off against somebody else. And in whatever way, try to, let's say, insult the person or put the person to trouble, sometimes by even telling lies. And I believe that rivalry is there, but there's some rivalry in political issues and some other issues, but it should be there, but we need to stand together. Maybe, but they're two brothers in the same family. They could have different tastes, but they don't. This doesn't impact their brotherhood. So they would not insult one another. That shouldn't be that way. So we need to be careful about this. That was one basic issue I just wanted to mention. I'm emphasizing it here, and I advise our youths that hate mongering should not happen within society. Well, maybe there are some differences of opinion, difference of taste, no problem about that. But we need to be standing alongside each other, just like brothers. We need to face issues together and stand against those who are opposing the Iranian nation and to move together. Now, as for international issues, The one with the highest priority is the issue of Palestine, the issue of Gaza. So also a few statements regarding this. Now, resistance in the West Asia region is the major issue that has attracted the world's attention. And there are a few aspects, from different aspects, you can look at the issue of Palestine. In the first place, what's happening in Gaza, the developments there, they indicate what the darkness that you see in this world, even though so-called advanced economies and powers of the world that they are always talking about and boasting of human rights and such issues, they proved that what kind of darkness spread all over the words and deeds. More than 30,000 people have been slaughtered. Infants, newly born to youngsters, teenagers, men, women, patients. In a matter of a few months, more than tens of thousands of them are killed or wounded. Their homes are destroyed. The infrastructure is demolished. And then you have the civilized world just looking. They're not stopping it. They even contribute. In the early days of this barbaric aggression by the Zionist regime against the people in Gaza, Americans were there. Europeans also showed their support for the Zionist criminals. And they announced it expressly. They did not suffice to that. They even sent armaments. They did funding. This is the darkness prevailing all over the world. This is the world that we are facing these days. The slogan of death to Israel. So this is the one aspect that you can consider, and that demonstrates the status of the world these days. There are some other aspects to consider too. Well, this also showed the righteousness and actually the true reason and for the resistance front. There were some people who were saying that the resistance front in the West Asia, why should it be there? Well, they questioned the existence. What's proven now that the existence of the resistance front is among the most vital issues in this part of the world. And every single day, this resistance front need to be boosted. Well, naturally, a conscientious person, those who are conscientious, when they witness the tyranny and oppression of the Zionists in this part of the world, it's been going on for 70 years. When you see this, you cannot sit idly by and do nothing. It's natural for them to put up resistance. This is what resistance is all about, to fight and to battle this incessant and perpetual oppression exercised by the Zionist criminals against the Palestinian people and their supporters. Another point, if you just consider another aspect, you see that in the past few months, the resistance front has actually unveiled its true status quo. The Americans, others in the West, and the regional states, probably they were not aware about the capabilities and the power of the resistance in the region as it really is now. They just realized it. They just did realize that power. Just look at the resistance that they are putting on. Look at the wall of resistance that the people in Gaza have created, and see how bravely, whether it's Hamas or other Palestinian fighters, see how they're fighting off the enemy. So this shows the strength of resolution in the resistance front in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Iraq. This is what you call resistance. This is the true capacities and capabilities of the resistance front, and they just unveiled and uncovered their whole capabilities and let the whole world see that. Slogans of death to America. Now, in this region, Americans were planning to actually rule over all aspects of life in this region. So this is the miscalculation that they had. This is how they thought that by maintaining presence in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, elsewhere in the region, that the power resistance stirred this, tilted the balance in its own favor, and it showed otherwise that Americans are not able to stay in this region. They have to leave and evacuate this region. There's also another aspect you can consider, the issue, and that is the situation of the Zionist regime. That's also for everyone out there to see. It turned out that the Zionist regime, they're not only unable to protect themselves, to get out of the crisis, they're again facing another crisis and problem. They're stuck in a quagmire and they cannot save themselves. There's no way out. So you see the Zionist regime, they entered the Gaza. That proved to be a quagmire. Now, if they get out of Gaza, they fail, even if they get stuck there. Again, they failed. This is the situation that the Zionist regime is facing now. The contradiction that you see in their decision-making and the bewilderment that you see, they're flabbergasted, and you can see that. There are divisions, deep cracks and divisions among the Zionist officials, among their own statesmen. They're unable to make decisions. Today, the Zionist regime cannot make a decision. So this, hopefully, will push them toward collapse, imminently. Now, as for the United States, now, regarding the Gaza issue, the U.S. also got the worst, adopted the worst position regarding Gaza. They did something that made the people all over the world hate it. I mean, those people you see on the streets of London, Paris, and elsewhere in Europe, and also even inside the United States of America, there are rallies for Palestine, and they show that they abhor, that they loathe America. America is being hated in the world. They were hated in the region, and that was even boosted 10 times as much. They have a wrong understanding of the facts in the region. So are their decisions. That's on the basis of that wrong understanding. Wherever in the region they have set foot, in Yemen, in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, whatever is done by resistance fighters in the region, then Americans refer that and attribute it to Iran. This is a wrong calculation, and finally this will bring America to its knees. They do not know the people. The brave people in this region, they're insulted. They have their own opinions, they have their own minds, they have resolute, they're brave people in the region. Of course, we stand with the resistance as far as possible. We support resistance groups to the best of our ability. We also praise the job that they're doing, but it's they themselves who are making decisions and they're taking action. And they're doing the right thing. We believe that this great tyranny and oppression that's happening in this region, and that's on the back of due to the existence of the Zionist regime. This is a big oppressive move, and this oppression and tyranny has been going on for tens of years. This needs to stop. This oppression needs to stop, and whoever is taking part in this humanitarian, in this Islamic, in this conscience-based jihad or holy struggle, whoever pitches in, we stick with them, and we support them, and we stand by them, and with the blessing of God, we will also accomplish our goal. And that's the end of the speech.
You're listening to the speech of the new year.
You've just listened to a live speech by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and just a quick recap of the main points which the leader made. Ayatollah Khamenei talked about this year's slogan, the leap in manufacturing and production with the participation of the people, and the leader said, it's very much possible, it's very much achievable that people can participate in the economy and they can benefit when the economy prospers. So this is very much achievable, he said. The leader of the Islamic Revolution also emphasized that the enemies have tried for years to seriously weaken our economy. They want to see Iran's economy brought down to its knees, he said. But we must use our highly skilled, talented young people, our high-tech, knowledge-based companies to boost the economy. The leader emphasized that the enemies, although they have tried to bring Iran's economy to its knees, they have failed in doing so. And we rely on our highly skilled, talented young people, our high-tech, knowledge-based companies to boost the economy. In other remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei talked about higher productivity in manufacturing and production and higher productivity in the agricultural sector in particular. He said, we need to raise our productivity. Our productivity is rather on the low side, and we need to raise that. And he also emphasized that the Iranian government's effort is dedicated to boosting the economy. He said the Iranian nation has great potential and great capacity to prosper. And he also talked about the importance of hope, hope for the future. He said, in this country, we have amazing, very exceptional resources and wealth, and this is a cause for hope. It gives us hope for the future. It says all of us should be hopeful and optimistic about the future, and many things which contribute to optimism about the future are things like Iran's scientific and technological advancement, which is ongoing. It's progressing all the time. Advancement in space and aerospace research, in many areas of technology, stem cells and so on, all these offer hope and optimism about the future. The leader of the Islamic Revolution also said that there should be more effort to have to do more in terms of trade and economy with friendly nations. We should do more to activate economic deals with friendly countries. And he also said that difference of opinion between people is quite natural in any society, in any country. You're bound to have differences of opinion between different people, but this must not lead to hatred or hate mongering, and this is certainly not acceptable if differences of opinion lead to hatred. That is not acceptable. And also the leader talked about what the situation in occupied Palestine, particularly in the Gaza Strip. He said American and European assistance to the Israeli regime is quite apparent. The whole world sees the United States and Europe helping Israel commit genocide in Gaza. The leader said Israel is committing all sorts of crimes and atrocities with assistance from United States and Europe. He also talked about the righteousness of resistance in occupied Palestine. He said resistance is the natural right of the oppressed Palestinian people. And he also talked about the importance of the resistance front in West Asia. He said this is very important. He said Gaza has turned into a quagmire for the Israeli regime. If they leave Gaza or if they decide to stay in Gaza, either way, they're stuck in a quagmire. And Ayatollah Khamenei also talked about the Americans, which have an incorrect understanding of the situation in West Asia. He said the oppression in Palestine, which has now literally been going on for decades, for over half a century, it must come to an end. Those were the main points by the leader of the Islamic Revolution. We now go back to our regular programming.
This is IRIB English Radio. What you just heard was our special coverage. We now return to our normal course of programs.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت القرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran.
کتاب الله.
In the limelight.
U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has said the Biden administration greenlighted the Israeli regime's massacre of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. She denounced Washington's arms aid to Israel as state-sponsored violence. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. China's Xinhua News Agency has covered this story and tells us more. The United Nations Human Rights Chief has expressed dismay concerning the brutality with which the Israeli regime is leading its ongoing months-long war of genocide in Gaza. Volker Turk told the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, Switzerland, on Thursday, 29th of February, there appear to be no bounds to and no words to capture the horrors that are unfolding before our eyes in Gaza. Tens of thousands of Palestinians, many of them women and children, have been massacred as a result of the Israeli military's onslaught in Gaza. Israel launched its campaign on 7th of October last year, following the Al-Aqsa storm operation, a surprise operation by Gaza's resistance movement against the occupied Palestinian territories. Volker Turk condemned the brutality of the Israeli response as appalling and entirely wrong. Meanwhile, the UN official warned about the pending dire consequences of a ground invasion that the Israeli regime has threatened to stage against the southern Gaza city of Rafah. More than 1.5 million of Gaza's 2.4 million plus population have fled to Rafah in southern Gaza Strip, finding nowhere else safe across the coastal sliver. Volker Turk said such a grand assault would contravene the orders issued by the United Nations highest court. On 26th of January, the International Court of Justice at The Hague, Netherlands, said Israel had to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of the Genocide Convention. Volker Turk said, "I fail to see how such an operation could be consistent with the binding provisional measures issued by the International Court of Justice. The prospect of an Israeli ground assault on Rafah would take the nightmare being inflicted on the Palestinians of Gaza into a new dimension." Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story. The European Union has wrapped a recent unjustifiable attack by the Israeli occupation forces on Palestinian civilians seeking food aid in the besieged Gaza Strip, calling for an international investigation into the deadly incident. In a statement on Saturday, 2nd of March, the European Union foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, condemned the restrictions imposed by Israel on the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza and the opening of Gaza's crossing points. He said the firing by Israeli troops on civilians trying to access foodstuff is unjustifiable. Josep Borrell added, "We request an impartial international investigation on this tragic event, allowing for a clear picture of the events and responsibilities." At least 112 people were martyred and more than 750 others were injured on Thursday, 29th of February, as the Israeli military opened fire on Palestinians who had surrounded a convoy of 38 aid trucks in Gaza, with the Palestinian Health Ministry calling the incident a massacre. The latest Israeli crime comes as non-governmental organizations and United Nations experts have on several occasions voiced fears of famine in Gaza. Gaza has been completely cut off from aid by the Israeli regime since October of last year. The European Union foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, emphasized that Israel shoulders responsibility of complying with the rules of international law and to protect the distribution of humanitarian aid to the civilian population of Gaza. The top EU diplomat pointed out, "The responsibility for this incident lays on the restrictions imposed by the Israeli army and obstructions by violent extremists to the supply of humanitarian aid." Josep Borrell warned that the restrictions on the entry of humanitarian assistance contribute to creating scarcity, hunger and disease, saying it would also lead to a level of desperation that brings about violence. He added, "Unabated fighting and disregard for international humanitarian law will lead to complete chaos, making the distribution of humanitarian aid impossible." Josep Borrell stressed the need to restore a minimum of order and security in Gaza to preserve a humanitarian space. Borrell added, "We urge Israel to fully cooperate with the United Nations agencies and other humanitarian actors involved in the humanitarian response and to allow free, unimpeded and safe humanitarian access through all crossing points in Gaza." The EU's top diplomat also urged Israel to swiftly remove the obstacles at the Kerem Shalom crossing and open the access in the north at Karni and Eretz crossings, to open the port of Ashdod to humanitarian aid and to allow a direct humanitarian corridor from Jordan into Gaza. He emphasized that airdrops should be a solution of last resort, given their minimal impact and their risk to civilians. Borrell also urged the United Nations Security Council to call for an urgent cessation of hostilities in Gaza. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story. U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has said the Biden administration greenlighted the Israeli regime's massacring of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Ilhan Omar denounced Washington's arms aid to Israel, calling it state-sponsored violence. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar made the statement at a press conference on Thursday, 29th of February, along with other U.S. lawmakers, including Representative Rashida Tlaib, Democrat of Michigan, as she voiced concerns about the high death toll of Palestinian civilians and the displacement of over 1 million people in the Gaza Strip, criticizing the Biden administration for approving additional aid to Israel without congressional approval. Ilhan Omar said, "This administration cannot claim to be an honest broker of peace while greenlighting the massacring of Palestinians in Gaza. The restocking of Israel's arsenal is not foreign policy, it is state-sponsored violence waged against defenseless families who want only to live in peace," Ilhan Omar stressed, if we truly want to uplift humanity, to protect the innocent people of Gaza, to bring hostages safely home, to hold out hope for peace, then we must demand a ceasefire in Gaza right now. Ilhan Omar also expressed disappointment with the response from the United States and the world's political leaders to Israeli atrocities in Gaza, underlining that empty rhetoric about human rights without any meaningful action is unacceptable. The Democratic congresswoman from Minnesota said the Biden administration's policies lack effective pressure on Israel and fail to deter the Israeli regime from continuing with its crimes against Palestinians. Ilhan Omar added, despite the clarity surrounding Gaza's despair, the response from political leaders has been nothing short of callous. Empty rhetoric about human rights ring hollow when no action follows. She added, this administration's policies fail to meaningfully pressure the Israeli regime through restrictions, sanctions, or any hint of consequences. Each war crime and violation compiled by journalists, human rights groups, and United Nations agencies are bearing witness.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Discovering Islam.
Based on the Islamic teachings, the soul lives after the body is dead and decomposed. Based on the same teachings, the souls will be resurrected in their bodies on the Day of Judgment. However, the question is, where would the soul go in the interim period between death and the Day of Judgment? Would they live or they will be in a state of oblivion? If they live, what type of life they would have? Do they feel happiness and pleasure and pain and agony? What about those souls who have not lived enough to attain merit or demerit? What about the children? What type of life they would have in that interim period? The world of the dead is usually portrayed as the most terrifying realm man has ever imagined, the realm of spooks. We are usually frightened even to think about it. However, based on the Islamic teachings, what comes after death and before the resurrection of the dead is a fascinating world.
The phases of our existence are divided into two. One is called al-dunya, this world, and one is called al-akhirah, what happens afterwards, the hereafter. Dunya is roughly divided into our existence as we walk about on earth and our existence when we lie under the ground. One is dunya, one is barzakh. Both of them are still dunya. They are not akhirah. So we define dunya as everything that happens before the blowing of the trumpet that brings an end to all this life. And that is divided into earthly life and barzakh.
Okay, there is the dunya and there is the akhirah. Okay, two very distinct. But there is a buffer world, or a world that in a way brings the two together. You know, it separates the physical world of the laws of physics and the world of spirits. And the two, you know, because of their very different laws and incompatibility, really.
In barzakh, the souls, if you like, are kept in waiting till the rest of humanity catches up with them, so that then they can enter the new phase of their existence, which is to be arrayed in front of their Lord on the Day of Judgment.
With death, we enter a world of wonders. We will have dreamlike experiences, which is far more different from what we now know.
The awareness in barzakh of an individual, believer or unbeliever, is vastly superior to the awareness of even the greatest scholars who are alive now, because there is an element of certainty in the vision that you have in barzakh, which is difficult to get in this world.
This stage of our life, or this stage of journey towards the Lord, is called with different names in Islamic literature. It is sometimes referred to as the middle world, or the world of images, Alamul Mithal, or the barrier world, Barzakh.
Barzakh is a variety of passages into the hereafter.
Something that separates two things is a barzakh. And that's why this realm is called the barzakh, because it divides this life that we live in right now from the hereafter. Although it's a very, very long time in between, nonetheless, since it divides these two from each other and separates them, it has been called the barzakh, where people go.
We call it barzakh because there is an impregnable barrier between that dimension and the dimension in which we live now. It cannot be penetrated back after the soul has passed through it with the help of the angel of death. Now, the Quran states that after they die, behind them is a barrier until the day they are resurrected.
The Quran states, and beyond them is a barzakh, or a barrier, before the day in which they will be brought forth. So the Quranic picture of barzakh is some sort of intermediary phase before the major day of resurrection.
Barzakh in Arabic just means barrier. Something that separates two things, like we have, for example, in the verse in Surah Rahman, that the sweet water and the salty water have a barzakh between them. And, you know, these waters can travel together without mixing, because there is this impenetrable barrier between them. In the same way, this barzakh, the intermediary world, because it is a buffer, if you like, between life of this world and the Day of Judgment. And these are one-way streets. People do not come back from them.
There is a point in the near-death experience that a lot of people mention, in which they have a point of decision, let's say. It could be sometimes a barrier that they are going to pass, or sometimes it's just a perception that if they move on, it's like a decision made, either I come back or I stay. Come back, I mean, to the intraphysical life, their lives back.
When we talk about the world of graves, we do not talk about the physical bodies buried here, rotten after a while. We talk about a world of a different dimension. We talk about the souls living in the spiritual bodies. Although they are connected to our world, but they live in a completely different dimension.
The grave referring to here, of course, is a spiritual grave, not the physical grave. You might have an individual who may not even have a grave. God forbid someone dies in the sea, and let's say maybe eaten up by the animals of the sea. So he or she may not even have a grave. But what we're talking about is the spiritual grave, not the physical grave.
Where is the soul of this body now? Does it really live inside this? According to our knowledge and according to the traditions that we have been taught, the soul is not related to this body anymore. The soul is living in a spiritual body. This body, whether rotten or kept intact, is of no use anymore.
The question that comes up is, why is it necessary to even have a barzakh realm, a barzakh world that we go to after death? Why not go straight to the hereafter? First of all, there's a fixed time for the hereafter. And in the Quran it says, عِلْمُهَا عِنْدَ رَبِّي, and the knowledge of the hour is with my Lord. So that has a fixed time, and now we're living in this life. And at the same time, we believe that the soul doesn't die. The body will die, will deteriorate. But the soul is to live on. Okay, so where is it going to be? What's going to happen? Because the hereafter hasn't arrived yet. The Day of Judgment hasn't arrived yet. Well, that's where it's going to be then. It's going to be somewhere. That somewhere where the soul is residing is called the barzakh.
What is the purpose of barzakh? My idea is that, of course, the Day of Judgment is a day when there will be a collective presence of humanity. But humankind comes to the earth and leaves the earth in groups. We don't all come together and we don't all leave together. But on the Day of Judgment, we all have to arrive together, which means that we need a holding area.
In this seir and this traveling towards Allah and movement towards Allah, this soul is developing slowly. They say that the barzakh is a place where souls are prepared either for the punishment or for the great rewards. In the barzakh, it is where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will sometimes have people compensate for what they missed in this life so that they don't miss out on the good stuff on that side. Of course, it doesn't mean that we have a chance to do good deeds there. That is done. But still, those good deeds that we did in this life, those good intentions that some might have had in this life, will have an effect on their development in the barzakh.
The traits that we allow our souls to be occupied in, or the dispositions that we form in this world, they become like the seeds germinated within fertile ground. They sprout and they come to the fullness of their existence, just like a baby through the influence of DNA becomes a fully grown baby, a fetus, before they arrive into this world. So before we arrive into the next world, we fully mature in accordance with those dispositions that we have brought upon our own selves within this world.
It's in that dimension which question about the past life of every individual buried takes place. And that is the world of the grave. That is Alamul Mithal.
Mithal means image, but not like the image we see in the mirror. Rather, it's an image not dependent on mass and matter, hence more abundant with life and freshness.
Sorrow and happiness, pain and pleasure, and any other quality that we experience in this world are but faint shadows reflected from that world on the dull face of the matter. A world in which the heaviness of the matter does not slow down the life, just like what we see in our dreams or experience in our imagination.
The pleasure and the pain of that world and the duration of that world can never be likened to this world, because in this world everything is watered down. My fullness of my pleasures cannot come to the fore, nor my pains or my fears, because there are limitations through matter. But in that world, there are no limitations.
The spiritual grave could be either a place of garden, heaven, paradise. Someone feels that he or she is receiving the blessings of God Almighty. Or it could be one of the pits of fire where the punishment will constantly endure.
The soul is subjected to confinement, pain, punishment, sickness, and grief, as they are to various states of joy, rest, bliss, and freedom. Now, all these are, of course, experienced in the spiritual body and not by the physical body.
In Barzakh, we would feel pain, sorrow, and happiness, absolutely, because these are aspects that deal with the nafs, and it does not deal with the physical body. Although they say there are some happy hormones in the body, there are some painful hormones in the body, but these would come as consequences, you know. So the soul or the nafs is what feels the pain and the pleasure, and that, since it never dies, it's not the physical body that feels the pain and the pleasure, you know. It's reflected on the physical body, but it's actually the soul or the nafs that is feeling it.
The Quran states that the life of this world is just play and sport, and that the real life will come in the hereafter. As the middle world or barzakh is one step ahead towards the hereafter, the life there must be much richer than what is experienced here.
The whole context that we understand this world is different over there. And therefore, it's very difficult for that human being. And same thing with the Day of Resurrection. Everything we know about that world and this world is going to be completely different as well.
This life is seen in Islam and the Quranic vision of Islam as being purely instrumental. It is a means to something much more. Okay, this life is simply a process through which we can start to fulfill the divine potential, which is within us, to live beyond the bounds and limits of this material world.
When the souls arrive in Barzakh, they find themselves in a new form of living in which the intensity of life and its dimensions are exponentially increased. The soul in its mithali body is the swiftest thing in moving, relocating, ascending, or descending from one place to another. However, based on the degree of their completion, they can be divided into various categories.
One cannot imagine how exciting the arrival of the soul to that world may be. It's so lush, so astonishing, so glorious, that it leaves the soul to marvel for a long time. It's an experience like the birth of the baby into this world from the womb. Now, the difference, however, is that the baby cannot remember anything from its previous world, whereas the baby's soul is very astute and can feel the difference.
There is a constant progression towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala at whatever age we go. The soul is not really bothered with whether it is 20 years old or 200 years old when it leaves the body. It is still very young in the great journey that is yet to come. It is an infant. It's just a case of relativeness. Yeah? Because when you're talking about the Day of Judgment itself being 50,000 years long, and Barzakh, God knows how many hundreds of thousands of years long, 200 years or 2 years old becomes very relative. The soul is still young. It has a lot of maturity and a lot of learning to do still.
By entering into that world, the soul moves one step forward, and its powers to comprehend the realities of existence increase. It is now one stage closer to the final destination, meeting with the Lord.
When the Prophet went to the dead of the Meccans that lay on the battlefield of Badr, he said, "Do you find the promise of God to be true?" The Sahaba said, "Ya Rasulullah, bal amwat." "O Messenger, these are dead people." He said, "No, asma'a minkum wa absar." He said, "No, they hear more than you do, and they see more than you do.
People in Barzakh are of different types, much more diverse than we see in this world. They eat and drink, but not of things of this world, and dwell, but not in places of this world.
Their food and drink and dress, their houses and furniture, their cities and neighborhoods are of diverse and dissimilar kinds. They may be poor or rich, beautiful or ugly, and happy or miserable. They are